summoned through the dimension of sound. People explore the musical world, which they believe to be true. But there is a world, unheard by some, that is filled with stories of an unknown reality, a jazz side.
Hi, my guest today on Tales from the Jazz Side is drummer Lionel Cordu. Hello, Mr. Cordu.
Hello, Veronica. How are you doing?
Thank you for coming and doing this. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. It's my pleasure to hang and put some information out about music.
Yeah, well, we've had enough coffee. I'm sure that we should be able to keep this at a clip that's fast enough for us. Okay, so now I'm going to start. I usually do some research on you and try to find out more. And besides us playing together with Michael, now you started playing at the age of 5, right?
Yes.
And it said that you were watching your brothers, right, play.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're the youngest of 5.
Yes.
Okay, what instruments did they play?
Well, back then, one of my brothers played guitar and keys, and my brother Harry played the bass, and then my brother Eddie played guitar and bass.
Wow, so nobody played drums.
No one played drums, no. So like, I was like, uh-oh, he's the one.
Right, because I was going to ask you, like when you guys were all playing in the church, like how did you, you know, play with them? Did you say, oh, I want to play the drums? But obviously they needed a drummer, right?
Well, yeah. Like what happened, like my brother's band used to rehearse in our house. And so his best friend, this guy named Tommy, mm-hmm. always had his drum set in the house. And I just gravitated towards that. And that's basically how I started playing. Like just like when they were done, I would just sit behind you. And then, and in church, they had a drum set there, but no one really played it. Like, there was a guy that would play it, but as I got older, like when I was like 11, 12, I basically took the spot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so basically when you started playing, it was around like gospel church music.
Yeah. Well... yeah, gospel church, but my brothers were huge. James Brown and Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, like that whole thing. Like that's what they used to rehearse.
Okay, right.
In the because house
you
could, all the time.
Because you guys were actually, James Brown grew up in Queens. I mean, he's lived there in Queens,
yeah, yeah,
right?
I was
reading that a lot of the musicians there, you had a chance to hear them.
Oh my goodness. Like that was a good thing about growing up in Queens at that time because... there, like a lot of musicians lived out there because, you know, I guess it was like their suburbia as opposed to Manhattan mm-hmm. and Harlem and, you know, that whole thing. So everybody moved out there. And then like they used to have block parties and that's where I would get to see, like, I remember seeing Marcus Miller and Omar and those guys and Lenny White and Stanley Clark at a block party. And then on top of that, the Jazzmobile, there was an organization called the Jazzmobile, and they used to like come on those open trailer trucks
mm-hmm. yeah.
and perform.
Wow.
So yeah, when I was like 10, 11 years old, like that's, you know, we used to like get on our bikes and ride to a block party and...
oh my God, yeah. That's like, you think of a block party today over like over here in Brooklyn. And, I mean, just to imagine, just they're right there playing right on the block, you know? Wow. So now going back to the church thing, your father was a minister.
Yes.
Right? And your mom sang in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? How was that being, first of all, with 5 of you, there's 5 boys, which I must have been really interesting for your mom. Did your mom ever say, I sure wish I had a daughter, or I wish I had a girl somewhere in the middle?
Well, she was tough because there were 5 of us. And I think it made me really respect women a lot because she did not take any crap and she was about 5 feet tall.
Wow.
And like all of us, all five of us are over 6 feet tall.
That's right. Yeah, you guys are really, you are tall. Yeah. Wow.
So yeah, like she did not take any crap. Wow. And like my dad was the period at the end of the sentence. there was solidarity.
Okay.
Like there was no, like she said it and then if you didn't sign the bill,
right,
it ended up on my father's desk.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Basically.
Yeah. So then that means that you guys were all relatively disciplined around the house. You didn't go like crazy.
No. Even years later, like when we were all adults, like none of us, like, you know, we all used to smoke cigarettes, but none of us would smoke cigarettes in front of them.
Oh, wow.
It was like that. It was like a real respect thing, yeah. Because we saw what they were trying to do, mm-hmm. You know, and it's funny. It's so funny thinking back on all of that now, like how, like a lot of people don't have that kind of stability.
That's very true. Yeah. Now we were talking about something earlier, which we won't get into here, but it did remind me of, now of all your brothers, was there a particular brother that you kind of hung with the most or you kind of got along better with than the rest, or was it kind of all an equal?
Well, my brother Eddie, there's a kind of an age divide. Like when my parents got married, they had 3 boys in a row. Then they took 10 years off.
Whoa. Oh,
and
wow.
Then they had my brother Eddie on that 10-year break. And then 3 years after that was me.
Oh,
so
okay.
I hung out with my brother Eddie a lot and we discovered a lot of music. Like he turned me onto a lot of music, but my one brother that really hooked me up musically was my brother Gene. Like he gave me my first Billy Cobb him record.
Oh, wow.
Like he was really, he really kind of got me to see what music is. And then my brother Eddie, because he was 3 years older than me, turned me on to all the stuff that was going on.
At the time, yeah. During your genre, during your generation.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty, it must be really amazing to have, you know, everybody in your family like being musical and you guys could play and just jam and perform together. I think that's a really unifying thing too. Music unifies you in mm-hmm. a way that, you know, maybe sitting around all reading together might, but I don't think so. You know, in the bio, it mentions that, you know, because you play with all these different types of rhythms and it's very specific and unique, you know, you have a very uniqueness in your sound. That it's a Caribbean heritage. They're saying it's now. Is your family from the Caribbeans, or are you?
Yes, my family's from Barbados.
Oh,
and
wow! I should have known that.
but I mean, I wasn't into that kind of music really back then. I was so much into Billy Cobham and Tony Williams and Steve Gadd and that whole, you know, I was so much into that I didn't really get into Caribbean music until I got older, you know, you start realizing, like, the connections between, like, reggae and jazz, like ska came out of jazz, and, like, that whole connection on how music develops and how it spreads. But that's when I got into Caribbean music. Like that's how I discovered Caribbean music. And it's kind of funny because I knew about jazz, but it was the first time I heard Tony Williams play the drums. It was on a Stanley Clark record.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard anyone play funk like that.
Oh.
And that made me want to see how he developed, and that's how I got into Miles.
Oh,
it was totally
different.
What?
Wow.
That's and like you know, my brother Gene said, "Well, if you like this guy, he played with Miles," and mm-hmm. that's how I.
Wow.
Got in
so it was from almost a kind of a funk thing. In with Stanley Clarke, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of then brought you more toward the traditional, even more so.
Yes.
Than you were.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. That, like, I was like 12, 13, 14 around that time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Then, well, you know, like, we're in, you know, in addition to like the education that you've got through performing and recording, I mean, because your discography, you've played on an awful lot of records.
Luckily.
A lot of records. Yeah, I mean, you know, I always would, I'm a little nervous about asking some of the questions about all the different records people play on because of, you know, some cats say, well, I recorded 700,000 records. I don't know, you know. But in addition to all that, those years that you have on that, we tend to get a music education too in a more direct manner. And I was reading that yours was through a training program sponsored by the local 802.
Yeah,
and I'm supposed to know something about this, but I don't know why I don't know about this.
Well, that program, I can't remember how I heard about it now, but it was this crazy thing that the union had developed between Manhattan School of Music. It was teachers from Manhattan School of Music and Juilliard, and they would teach like out of Kingsborough College and Lehman College.
Okay.
In the Bronx.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was this, it's crazy. It was like a crash course teaching program, 2 days a week, because everybody, just about everybody at that program played in a band, like guys that traveled around.
Yeah,
all
so they
the
were
time.
Actually, yeah, living it and playing it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it was like Monday and Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m.
That's like gig, old school gigs.
10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And it was like, and it was 2 days a week. And then as a percussionist, I played in the orchestra, I played in the concert band, I played in the jazz band,
wow.
Like, and I played in the percussion ensemble, like, so I always had to be there, and plus I wasn't gigging back then like
right.
everybody else.
So right, so you'd be there from 8 in the morning to
ten
all day long, you'd be all day.
Yeah, and then, you know, I'd come in on Tuesdays and Thursdays and practice. Yeah. I mean, it was a great program. I got a chance to hang out with guys that were working already,
mm-hmm,
and like a lot of those guys were great. They inspired me to keep going. It was nice.
Yeah.
It was sweet. Yeah.
Yeah, because it, you know, I really feel it's important that we work and learn from people who are working.
Yeah.
Who really are out there, because they can give an added thing to it that, you know, if it's just academic, you know, then that's just what it is. But there's so many other levels to that,
mm-hmm,
when once you get out there doing it, you know, and they cannot always guide you in that way. Now, you came, when you were doing that, you worked with Stanley Cowell.
Yeah.
And, you know, I looked him up and listened to some of his, you know, I didn't really know much about him,
mm-hmm,
or anything about him, to be honest with you. And it's amazing how he was just really a person people should know exists.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. Tell us about.
Stanley Cowell's a piano player. He played with Max Roach for some years. But when I met him, I was in college and he was a professor. And he was, he taught music history and he taught the jazz combo. That's how we met. And he really, because he used to play at the Blue Note. And like I would, anytime he would be playing there, I would go see him there or at the Vanguard.
Wow.
And that was sweet. Like I saw him play with Tane.
Oh, really?
When Tane was like really young.
Wow.
And like I remember Stanley got off stage. He said, man, he just beat me up. But they were killing. It was unbelievable. And he actually hired me because he was writing all this music, and he hired me to play with him at Carnegie Hall.
Right. That was when I was going to ask you about that. I mean, that you were what, 16? How old were you when you did that?
I was in college. I was like probably 18, 19.
And what was that? What was it like to...
Well, the preamble to that was like we, like the thing about Stanley too, he was a great guy. I remember before I got to Carnegie Hall with him, we played in some women's prisons. So like there was some stepping stones. I didn't go from the classroom to Carnegie Hall.
Well, no, that's actually the direct path to get to Carnegie Hall, right through prison.
Like I remember it was me here, Reggie Workman. And, I can't remember the saxophonist, but I'll never forget, we did like two gigs.
What was that like?
It was unbelievable.
Was it like the Johnny Cash experience type of thing?
I mean, like, yeah, like, there was a process to get to Carnegie Hall. But I remember the first time the guy said to me, when you're going through security at a prison, you know, they put this tag on your arm, and he goes, it doesn't matter what, if you don't have that tag on, you're not getting out.
Oh, my God.
So needless to say, I kept checking
for the tag. Right, I know, right? My hand would have been on it the whole time, you know, always.
But you know, Stanley was smart enough to realize, you know, let me see how this guy performs,
you know. In this kind of environment.
Yeah.
Right. And do you feel the audience was... You know,
oh, they loved us. I mean, it was great. I can't imagine what it would be like being in jail, but to be in jail and be able to see some live music must have been an incredible thing.
Right. That's amazing. Was that do you know if that was a program that was from an outside organization that did it, or the prison system participated maybe with? Do you know where that
No. Yeah. I was like 19.
Yeah, well, you didn't even like care. 18. You didn't care, right, man? You're on your way to Carnegie Hall, man. It's like, what? What? So talking about the Carnegie Hall.
Well, with Carnegie Hall, I didn't even play drum set on that gig. Because in college, I played a lot of percussion. Like, I played in the symphony, and I played in the percussion ensemble. And Stanley actually... knew that, and I think that's what he liked about me.
Okay.
Like, because he knew I could play drums.
Right.
But for the concert, I played marimba, vibraphone, and we did have a snare drum and a hi-hat and a ride cymbal, because there was a piece where I did have to swing, but it wasn't like a drum set kind of thing. It was beautiful. The band, I remember it was bass. Reggie Workman played bass. There were two violinists, a cellist, and me, and Stanley, and a saxophonist. I can't remember who the saxophonist was, but yeah. And it was this beautiful music that he composed. And I mean, for me as a kid, to be at Carnegie Hall like that was just incredible. And like that kind of gave me the hope, like,
okay, there's possibility here that I can do that. You know, and thinking of possibility, when you go with, you know, you talk about a big break, you know, when somebody gets their big break. Now, your idea about break, like, when was that moment? You were saying that it was Carnegie Hall where you had that moment of like, I'm on my way. I'm on my way. Was it like, I'm on my way, or there is potential? I mean, was there a moment when you were just, I don't know, doing a gig or you're somewhere and you just say, man, this is it. I'm gone now. I'm on my way. Do you have a...
No, actually.
No, really? I don't think anybody ever did. I mean, but say, okay, well, look, I was reading Dean Brown, right? And Schuyler Deal? Skylar Deal. Yeah. Ooh, I hope you didn't hear me say that, but Skylar Deal. These cats heard you in a club, right?
Yeah.
Like, and then isn't that after that? Everything going, no more women's prisons for you, man.
You know, it's so funny. Like, I used to play, like, when I got out of college, I my brother Gene played with this guy named Little Buster. He was a local guitar, blues guitar singer, great, amazing singer, and he was blind, and he used to work in Long Island 6 nights a week.
Wow.
So when I got out of college, like, I needed a gig, and my brother was like, yo, why don't you sub? And like, that's how I started playing with Buster. I started subbing, and then the drummer, some stuff happened with the drummer, and then I ended up doing that gig. And one of the stops on that gig, through our weekly, because we used to play from Tuesday to Sunday. Mm. The only night we had off was Monday
night. Wow.
And one of the stops was Thursday at this club in Long Beach, Long Island, called the C Note, Carol's Place. Mm. And that's where I met Dean Brown.
Okay.
Because Dean Brown is, he played with Sanborn, he played with Marcus Miller. You know, he's teaching now out in California, but back then he used to live in Long Beach, and he loved this guitarist named Little Buster was his name.
Okay.
He loved him, so he would come out to see him, and that's how I met Dean and Skylar, because Skylar lived out there too. Skylar at that time was playing with, he had a band in Long Island called the Good Rats.
Oh, I like that name.
And, but like, Skylar went on to play with Billy Joel and Michael Bolton, and like Billy, like he played with Billy Squire, like that whole
scene. Yeah.
And Julian Lennon he played with, and you know, Skylar's retired now; he's a rock star. and so that's how I met those guys. And actually, Dean Brown. Like, he was playing with Kurt Whalum, too, at that time, and Bob James. And Kurt's drummer, this guy named Herman Matthews, got a gig with Kenny Loggins.
Ah.
And Dean recommended me.
Yeah, there you go.
He was like, yo, Lionel could do it. So I ended up, that's how
there you go.
Dean and I started playing together, and I started playing with Kurt Whalum.
Yes, there you go. Yeah. So that's kind of like that moment when, you know, you fall right into that right flow.
Yeah.
And then everything just keeps flowing from that. And, you know, the next group of people you meet and you connect and you record with them and then you tour with them. And it's always kind of from the women's prison to, to, you know, we don't
know. Carnegie Hall.
To Carnegie Hall to, you know, being on the big stage with all the other legendary people.
Yeah.
You know, it's always so hard to define that, you know, to know when that moment is. But when we think about it, we do know.
Yeah,
so it's like, wait a minute. You know, I've told the story many times before, going to the jam session at Rathbones, where I met Charles.
Yeah.
And from Charles there to go Michael Franks. And it was a weird place, didn't want to go. And, you know, sawdust on the floor. I was like, oh, I don't want to go out another jam session, you know.
And you
go anyway. You do the gig anyway. You go out and you do it anyway. And the next thing you know, it changes. It changes where everything is. So that was your kind of big break, you know.
Yes.
So now with your big break, standing where that is, you've toured, performed, and recorded with Mike Stern, Gino Vannelli, Kyle Eastwood, Angelique Kidjo.
She was amazing. My God.
She is unbelievable, you know. This list is unbelievable. Lonnie Plaxico, Cassandra Wilson, Roberta Flack, Gatto Barbieri, Bill Evans. I don't want to leave out everybody. Warren Hill, John Lucien, Kirk Whalen, as you mentioned, Special Effects.
For 20 years.
Yeah, so you've been playing with them for a long time, 20 years.
Yeah, Chiele Minucci. Chiele Minucci.
Yeah, and now how did you get moved into that gig?
That was, oh my God, that came out of, I think that was Dean again. I think that might have been Dean Brown again. I think he knew they were looking for a drummer. And they came to see me play. Well, first of all, that band at the time was head up by two guys, George Jinda, who passed away, and Chiele Minucci. And I remember I was playing with this great writer, this guy named Peter Zizzo, and they came to hear me play. And I didn't think I got the gig. I saw them when the gig started.
Yeah. And
we played the first song, and they left.
Really?
And I was like, well.
Okay, well, fine, man. You know what I'm saying? I gave my whole heart. Right? I gave everything I had, man.
Like, the first song, like, and, like, I saw them walk out. And I was
right,
like, well.
So, okay, there we go.
That didn't happen.
I got to see what's happening down at the women's prison.
Back to the prisons again. And then, like, they called, like, the next day.
Wow.
George, I think George called and said, yes, we saw, George was from Hungary, so, and he was hilarious. And he said, yes, we saw you play, and we knew in the first song that you
were. Oh, yeah, that was it. Yeah, and that's really great, you know, just even like 10 measures or less than 10 measures they knew right away.
So I couldn't believe it, like, I couldn't believe
it. I know. Yeah. Now, I know you had to have thought, now I'm on my way.
Yeah, well, that band was the first band that I've been in and have toured. And
for a long period of time, yeah.
I don't know, how many records? Like,
yeah.
8 records, something like that.
That's right.
Those guys, yeah. And been all over, like, that was the start of all the traveling.
Yeah, so that one is really where it just gave you a whole nother perspective of, you know, you think of the possibility, you know, when you played at Carnegie Hall, but then when you're out there traveling all over the world and you're doing something you love and you're playing with great musicians, that really gives you a whole nother view. Because not a lot of musicians get that opportunity to experience something like that.
Yeah.
You know, they still play at some place. I mean, it isn't that they're not as good, you know, or anything at all like that. It's just that being in that right place at the right time and having skill and being disciplined and, you know, because sometimes it's something as simple as just how disciplined you are.
You are, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? You can have two great players, but one is really very business-oriented, calls you back, do what, you know, you need to do, and the other one is kind of like, oh, well, you know, whatever, I can, you know. Yeah, man, it's a major 7th with the flat at 5th. So whatever it is, you know what I mean? They're not as business-oriented. Yeah. So it's kind of... Now, my last episode, we had... and this was 5 months ago, 4 months ago. You're kickstarting my tales again, which I appreciate. Really appreciate you doing it. It makes me go out and do interviews. But I had Jimmy Haslip on, and he was talking about being a left-handed bassist. You know, and having to do the bass and create all that stuff. And you are a righty.
Yes, I am.
Who plays the drums left-handed.
Yes.
Okay. So what happened? Well, how did that happen?
It is the freakiest thing. Like, my mother said when I was 3, because my brother Gene and Harry, they're almost 13 years older than me.
Right.
That when I was 3, their bands were rehearsing in our house.
Okay.
And my mother said I used to sit on the last step in the basement and watch the drummer, whoever was playing drums, and like air drum them.
Wow.
But she said they didn't realize that I was doing a mirror image instead of the actual...
Right.
Playing right-handed, I would look at the drummer and play, do what exactly how he did when you're facing.
Yes, right. Wow. Wow.
And she said that when I was like 5, that I took the pots and pans out and I set them up like a drum set. But she said I set them up from that perspective.
Wow.
From, like, lefty. And that's how I started playing lefty. And I play all musical instruments left-handed. Guitar and bass, I play left-handed.
But you write with your right hand.
Yeah, I write with my right hand. I eat, well, I...
You eat with your fingers.
But
fingers in both hands.
But I bat right hand. I play basketball right hand. I do everything else right handed except music.
Wow. Wow. Well, wait a minute. That could make sense because of the hemisphere of the brain, yeah. The creative part of the brain, you know? I should try to, like, do more stuff with my left hand. I'd never be anywhere near as great as you are, but still, it would be nice. I'm going to try that. I'm going to try doing stuff. Even right now, I'm using my left hand to indicate. Now, why I brought that up was I also look, when I look at the different drum things, and I notice that they have a thing called configurations. Mm-hmm. And this is not for drummers. These are for people who don't know anything about drums. But what is the significance or interest that a drummer would have knowing another drummer's configuration, or why they would even have that on a page for the drums?
Well, because, I mean, if you're, well, when you look at the details, if you want to look at the details, it's always nice to see how drummers have the drums set up. Like, I mean, more so now than 15 or 20 years ago, because back then everybody set up, you know, toms from small to large, going at, for a right-handed drummer from left to right. But now so many drummers now have, would have a 12-inch tom all the way to the left, and then a 10-inch tom as their second tom. And so, and plus to see how people set up their cymbals, like where they have their crash or their ride, or where they have a 16-inch cymbal. It's nice to see the configurations of how you can set up drums. And now kids like drummers now are doing so many interesting things, like having snare drums as a floor tom, having it tuned really low. As a floor tom, and when you take the snares off, it sounds like a floor tom, but when you put the snares on, it has this beautiful, fat snare drum sound.
Wow.
So, and I love to see diagrams like that so that you can see what people do and how they set up and where they put things.
Now, is there like a real specific way? I mean, like, you know, a base for how you should technically set it up, but you can do variables. I mean, is there like, you know, how like on a piano you have the scales, you know,
yeah, CDFJ. Yeah.
So, but for drums, is there like a thing where they say, okay, you should have the snare here, da da da, or does it not matter at all?
Well, it used to matter. Well, if you're just teaching someone, you can give them a standardized setup.
Okay.
You know, hi-hat on the left, snare drum next to it on the left. Then the first tom would be right in front of the snare drum. Could be a 10-inch or 12-inch tom. And then a floor tom, usually about 14 or 16 inches. Yeah, you can start someone off like a kid with that kind of configuration just so they could they can learn how to develop patterns.
Okay.
But these days now with cable hi-hats, like you can have the hi-hat pedal normally where the hi-hat would be, but because of the cable, you can put it anywhere around the drum set.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's so many ways now because of the mechanics that have developed the way how cymbal stands are and how you can manipulate the way where you can put a drum so effortlessly, and with racks, you know, you've seen like you know, there's a great drummer, this guy, well, there are a couple of guys now, but the first guy I saw doing anything like that was a guy named Terry Bozzio. Had a drum set with, like, you know, 30 toms and 36, like Billy Cobham. I remember the first time I saw Billy Cobham play, it was at the Bottom Line, and he was using fives, and these drums were, it was like a fiberglass, but he had clear ones.
Okay.
And he had two bass drums and four toms and three floor toms.
Wow.
I remember seeing, like, that's what got me into noticing the configuration thing. Because Billy played a southpaw, even though his drum set was set up right-handed, his ride symbol was on the left side as opposed to the right side, like a normal right-handed drummer.
Okay.
And then I could play a right-handed drum set set up like that.
Okay.
And actually, when I was a kid, my teacher was a guy named Walter Perkins. He taught me jazz. But I remember when I wanted to go sit in at clubs, he would switch the drum set around for me. But he told me, hey, I'm the only one that's going to do this, so you better go home. And I switched my drum set around to the way Billy Cobham played, with the ride cymbal on the left side and the drum set up right-handed otherwise.
Okay.
And I learned how to play that way so I could sit in. And that's how I started getting gigs. Like once I started going to jam sessions and going to people's gigs, I would sit in and they would hear me play or see me play right-handed.
Yeah.
And then when I would show up, if they would hire me, I would show up and set up left-handed. Right. And they would go like, what are you doing? But yeah, so like configurations for me meant something because that's how I manipulated the world so I could play whenever I went out somewhere.
Wow. So that actually was very helpful for me in being clear. 'Cause we all look at our instruments very specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you play a particular instrument, there are things that you hone in on or focus on and notice that other people never will. For me, it's how singers stand and whether they use a mic in their hand or they use a stand. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like little things like that. And those are things just pop right out at you when you're out there. So now I wanted to ask you, since you have been on so many recordings, are you working on anything right now, on a project with anybody, or are you working on something of your own, or, you know, do you write a lot? Do you
I just wrote my first real country song.
Really?
A couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Getting ready for Folsom Prison?
Well, you know, you got to go back. Once you go forward,
you got to go back.
You got to go back.
So you wrote your first country song.
Yeah, I was watching the show called The View, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I DVR all the time, and I was watching one night I came in, and they had this singer, I can't remember her name, this country singer, and she performed live on the show. And I had, you know, I keep a guitar in the living room, and I was, you know, picking through the song. And then when the show went off, I just sat there and I had this idea and I just went down in the basement and that was the birth, yeah.
Now, when you sing it, do you sing it with a country twang? Well,
there are no vocals on it yet.
Oh,
I have to write some.
You're going to write it?
Actually, maybe I could, maybe you could write some lyrics.
Well, I definitely can get that accent because that's where I'm from.
But yeah, and you know, it's been so much fun because earlier this year I bought a guitar, an acoustic guitar.
Ah.
And it was a great opportunity for me to record it and, you know, and it was just fun. Like, it's just a fun thing to do, to spend a couple of days.
Yeah, now how's your fingertips on that? I mean, you know. Because well, I'm telling you,
guitar.
I have one and they bleed. They bleed.
I've played the bass and the guitar all my life, basically.
Oh, so you have a, it's
not as
sensitive to it. Is your, what are the strings? Are they steel?
Steel string, yeah.
Oh man, that's like, you know, it's like you hit a nerve ending with nothing.
Well, like, not to change the subject, but that was the thing that drew me to Jimmy Haslett.
Okay.
Because we play the bass the same way, exactly the same way. Like, I remember the first time I saw the Yellow Jacket, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, the first thing I noticed was that he didn't flip, like, he plays left-handed, but he didn't flip the strings
around.
Right. And when I first saw him, I was like, wait a minute, that's how I play.
Yeah.
I play exactly like that.
And so you actually played lots of gigs with him, too.
Yes,
I love him. Yeah, he's a really wonderful, incredible bass player, writer,
amazing.
And nice person, producer.
Sweetheart.
Yeah, just a very good, you know, and it's always nice to play with people like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to ask you, before we get into the psychological parts of the show, mm-hmm. Do you remember your very first recording or your very first record that you worked on?
Yes. All right. Now, this is the first time I've been in the studio or the first... All right, I'll tell you the first time I heard myself on the radio.
Oh, okay.
The recording from that.
That's good. That's good.
It was a New York Voices record.
Oh, okay. They're nice. I like them. They're great.
And it was, the guy producing the record was a guy named Leon Pendarvis. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. they had some tracks done. And I think they had a sequence track and they wanted live drums on it.
Ah.
And I just got a call, you know, can you come in the studio next day? Because I used to play with in a band with this bass player named Tom Barney,
mm-hmm.
who's an amazing bass player. And he recommended me. And I got a call one day, can you be in the studio tomorrow? Da-da-da. No one said who it was or what. And like, since I was just adding drum tracks, mm-hmm. it was Tom and I, we were putting bass and drums on it. And, you know, walked in, did the two tracks,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sitting in the lobby waiting for my check,
mm-hmm.
and the receptionist is like, yeah, oh man, you sound great on those tracks. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's funny. He goes, man, like, what's it like playing with New York Voices? And I was like, who? I was like, that's them? And I had no idea who it was, and luckily I didn't know before, because I would have been totally nervous, right, and worried about every note I played, and I didn't know who it was.
Right.
I just thought it was great. The singing,
right,
you know,
right.
the vocals were great, and luckily I didn't know before.
What?
And I got my check, and I remember driving home. I was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I just played.
Right.
And then, you know, there was, I can't remember if it was RVR or CD 101.9, but I remember I was in my car and the new record from New York Voices. And I was like, that's me. That blew me away. It was so, was surreal.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I remember first time WBGO, I heard myself on mm-hmm. WBGO, and I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just didn't seem, you know, it's like, oh, I must have my CD in, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I must have my own cassette even, you know, I must have that in there. No, that's incredible.
But then the trippy thing was, like, a couple of months after that, they were playing in New York, and Tom Barney and I went to their gig.
Oh, to the gig, yeah.
And to hear the drummer in the band
play your licks and stuff. Yeah, your parts, yeah. That's like, I've made it.
Like, to hear the drummer cop what I played.
Yeah.
Was, like, that blew me away.
Mm-hmm. It's like Tony Williams. It's like seeing it. It's seeing you from a different perspective, right?
That's,
it's like
that, incredible. I sat there in the audience, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, he did, like one of my fills.
Yeah.
That I stole from somebody else, right?
Right?
Right, right. Because that's all music is.
Yeah,
we all take from everybody.
Ripping off everybody. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. So, but do you remember, like, the first time you went into a studio and you had to go behind some device, you know, like an actual, the recording for the first time?
Yeah.
How old were you? And
it was this band my brothers and I had. We had this band with the singer named Diane Jenkins. And this was years ago. I was like 16, 17. And there's a studio called Systems 2.
Yeah, that's where we make all our records.
Yeah.
Yeah, Systems 2 is great.
Yep.
It's such an easy, relaxed mm-hmm. studio to work in.
And that was my first recording.
Wow.
And it was almost like a disco-y kind of thing. Was just it was kind of that kind of groove.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, like, that wigged me. I didn't know how to tune drums. I like back then, everything had to be dead, and
yeah
it was all taped up
yeah,
and everything.
Yeah.
It was a totally different scene, like the whole studio vibe. I knew nothing about microphones or where they should go. I remember sitting behind the drums and watching the engineer put everything there.
Yeah, probably Mike, right?
Yeah,
still Mike there.
It was great.
Yeah, and it's such a different environment. I mean, you can be in the studio for hours and hours and hours and just get totally lost with where time is, you know, if it's day or night and everything. And Systems 2 is a great studio.
Yep.
Yeah. So now I want to have you walk down into the basement with me.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we go under the subconscious. No, not really. So the first question, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, the first question. What is the scariest subject, like in any medium, like a painting, a book, a television show, or dreams, real life, you know, sometimes people, that you've encountered that's kind of scary to you?
Subject matter?
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. Like, I love any type of horror fiction and horror movies.
That's my thing.
I love that. Some people, their scary thing was Ebola virus. You know, I mean, it's like, it can be anything, but something that just kind of, you know, specifically with you, it's just kind of a...
Well...
You can be serious or not serious, you know.
No,
we're not going to judge you.
I have this crazy, and I think it's due to music, like the connection. Like, being a musician, like, you're really open. You almost have to read each other's minds on stage because everything is happening right then and there in the moment. So you have to listen that attentively. And sometimes you do have a connection. Like, I know there's certain people that I play with. I know what they're going to play. Like, I could just feel it before it's happening. But that kind of opened my psyche to other things. Like, I mean, sometimes... And I know it has to do with my background being in church, but I do have this thing with ghosts and like the way you feel when you walk into a room sometimes and traveling through the world.
Yes.
If you're open, if you're really sensitive to things, sometimes when you walk into a room or walk somewhere, you feel the things that you feel that are not from within. It's there. It's there already. And, like I have this weird thing, like just a couple of years ago, I was out on tour and we were in Germany and they had a beautiful pool in the hotel. I went for my swim. We had that day off. I went for my swim. I came up to my room and I felt just overjoyed with life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here I am, just got out of the pool, great day. And I was just, in that moment, I was consumed with life, the pleasure of being alive. And I went to the window and I opened the curtain to my room and there was a graveyard.
Wow.
There.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And I sat on the bed and I started thinking, why am I so inundated with this emotion, the joy of being alive, being here right now? And
and that's which seems the opposite. Death seems the opposite of life, but it's part of the continuum.
And I started thinking, you know, is it me or is it the environment?
Yeah.
That's making me, because of that, there. Was that influencing my joy? Like, the totally opposite is right there, and here I am
in
life now.
Right.
And yes, you know, The Exorcist scared the living daylights out of me. Like,
and they
all
have
of
a new
that.
One, right? They got a new series coming out, right? Exorcist series.
I mean, yeah, like that. I have this fascination with that. Like, I watched. All the ghosts, like Haunted. Yeah,
Destination America, I think they have one.
I mean, because, like I said, I mean, there have been times in my life where I felt things when I go certain places or be around certain people. I mean, we give off energy. That's what we are as human beings. I know a lot of people don't realize that, but when you walk into a room, you bring everything with you.
Yeah.
And if you're sensitive enough to see, to open, be open enough to feel what other people have.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and to be a really, well, I think, to be a great musician, or to, if you aspire to be that, you almost have to be that open.
Oh, yeah.
You have to let the moment dictate what you do, but you have to be open to see it. Like, I know with playing with Michael, the way I play with Michael Franks is not the way I would play with Mike Stern. It's a totally different ball game. The situation is different. Michael Franks, his vibe is different. Mm-hmm. His energy is different. The material is different. Mm-hmm. So I have to be able to adapt to that and get in that and do that to 100%. And then when I play with somebody like Mike Stern, it's the same situation. His vibe is different. Mm-hmm. The music is different. Like everything is different. So then I have to apply myself 100% to that.
Right, right. And no matter what, it's you doing it. I mean, it's always the core of it is you.
Yeah.
And that gives us that understanding that within us are all of these variables, all of these different life states that we could bring forth at any time to connect. That's actually really fascinating that, you know, especially when you travel in countries that are really old, you know, buildings that are, you know, 500 to 600 years old, 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
There's energy, that energy there, you can just, you know, it's, you just feel it. You totally feel it. Okay, so now, tell us about someone you have worked with who was a little frightening to you, but in a good way. And we don't want people dissing people.
Frightening, but in a
you know how way. Yeah just yeah. You know what I mean, that's
I gotta tell you, when I first played at Carnegie Hall, the bass player was a guy named Reggie Workman.
He's an amazing bass player.
And I remember the rehearsal, like Reggie, his sense of time and the way he swings is so open and big and beautiful, but I was so intimidated because I knew who he played with.
And
I remember the first like time we played, like I counted off the song and I'm playing and I knew where one was, and then Reggie went into his thing and I couldn't find one. I couldn't find one. And I remember we took a break, and I said to Stanley Cowell, I said, Stanley, like, I don't know where one is. And he said, you just got to take control.
Interesting.
You make the one.
You make the
You're the drummer.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so Reggie intimidated me. I mean, he didn't do it on purpose. He was just doing his thing. But out of that, I learned that, okay, I got to lay it down. Like, I have to be the one to lay this thing down. And it made me realize that I'm the framework. Mm-hmm. I'm the keeper of the framework. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what he plays.
Yeah.
I have to be the one to take everybody on this journey.
Yeah.
I'm the one. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. Now, that actually kind of brings into that, the last question is, like, what is the scariest thing that has ever happened to you while performing live?
Wow. I'll tell you the first thing that popped into my head. Well, there were a couple of things.
Yeah, please mention
There's
them.
There's been more than one.
That's okay. I don't want to hear them. Yeah.
All right. Really quick, I'll tell you a couple. I was playing in front of City Hall here in New York. And it was during the summer, and it was the last song of the show. It was with this great singer named Philip Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And great band, and we're playing, and the bass player had an epileptic fit.
Oh, no way.
Mm-hmm.
No way.
Yeah.
No.
And
oh my God.
It was the last song of the night.
And well, what I mean, Did he just pass out or did he?
Yeah, like we were into the last song and all of a sudden I could just see him from the back. I couldn't see him from the
right,
front.
Right, right, right.
But he just locked up and he just
wow,
face planted oh. right over. And I remember the first thing I did when I saw him hit the ground, because, you know, his bass was still plugged in. Mm-hmm. I reached over and I pulled the cord.
Right, so it didn't get that ring thing yeah. there. And you were just, what was going through your head? I mean, what
no
was,
one knew what to do.
Wow.
And I remember within seconds, this woman ran up on stage and she said she was a nurse. And we had already flipped him over and took the bass, and he was just on the ground.
Wow.
And yeah.
Wow, that's scary.
That was the first one. And then the
second. And the audience, I mean, what did they hopefully well, they weren't the kind of audience that wanted you guys to finish the song.
Wait a minute, like I came for this free concert.
I want my money worth, you know? It's like, okay, well, you know, we're in a serious situation here, you know? So, you know, we've been there, so.
Yeah, but it wasn't that. I mean,
it
like
was, everybody it, yeah. was compassionate cool, yeah. and open and everything.
Yeah, but that was the first wow. time anything like that has happened. I mean, I remember playing, oh man, years ago. This was like the scary, we were playing in Seattle and I was playing with Nelson Rangel. And it poured. It was pouring. I mean, they had the stage yeah. covered.
Right.
And it was Nelson Rangel and David Sanborn. And Sanborn at the time was doing this tour with an orchestra, but he wasn't carrying the orchestra with him. He had a rhythm section, you know, bass, drums, and piano, and he would hire an mm-hmm. orchestra. And I remember, well, this is actually funny, the conversation with David Sanborn's manager and the promoter, mm-hmm. like watching that right before we went on.
Oh.
And like they're like, because there were literally guys on stage with squeegees,
wow,
pushing the water
right,
off the
right,
stage,
right.
And we were terrified that we're gonna get electrocuted.
Yeah.
Like we're gonna play, and those people weren't leaving.
No, no,
they weren't leaving.
Yes.
It was packed out there,
yes.
And they all had their rain
needed,
cover
right,
umbrellas.
Right.
And I remember hearing him go, well, look, you got to go on. I mean, we're doing the gig.
And all you could think of is that while you're sitting behind all this metal.
And the microphones and the cables.
Yes, all
and
there.
All over the stage. And I remember walking out there going, like, this is crazy.
Right, right, right.
And luckily, nothing happened. Nothing happened. And we went on, we did our set, and then David Sanborn went up.
And you were like, I'm so glad our stuff is over.
And like the string section, I'll never forget the violas, they were in the back, mm-hmm. like close to where I could see, and the water, like the cover, the water
oh.
was hitting the back of their chairs.
Oh, man.
And yeah, and they had to go on, but I was terrified while I was up there. Mm-hmm. And then when David and those guys went up and played, I mean, I wasn't as scared. I was scared for them, but
right, but yeah, because you've already made it through.
Yeah, right.
I mean, because you know, there's things go through your mind, and you're still having to play.
Yeah,
you know, you're still having to you know, play the arrangement and all that, and yet there's that thing where
ooh.
You know, you're hypersensitive to. Do I see a spark
yeah.
somewhere? Do I, you know, what is the thing that's going to trigger, you know, electrocution is happening.
Oh.
You know what I mean? You just really.
I mean, I'm wet. My cymbals are wet.
Wow.
The pedals are wet.
Wow.
I mean, and while we're playing, there's guys in front of the stage where all the monitors and
yes.
like Nelson's playing into a microphone.
Wow.
And they're squeegeeing. The front
wow.
of the stage, they're coming behind me.
Oh.
And I was like, this is.
And that's what's in Seattle?
Yeah.
And you know, Seattle usually always has just light rain. It never mm-hmm. really has oh. hard rain. Like, you know. Wow. So that was Yeah, so those are definitely scary things, but you do it anyway because the guy was saying earlier, right? You could go tell Nelson, "I'm sorry, but I'm not going. I'm going. I'm gonna have them drive me back to my hotel room." You know, it's a paid gig. It's something you're responsible and you're committed.
You are part of the team.
Yeah,
and that's the thing that I, as a musician, I mean, to guys that are coming up now, remember something that you're obligated. Like once you accept the gig, you know, be diligent, learn the music. And for me, it was always about, if I know the music, I can go there and have fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to stress about the music. I could get into just hanging because I know the music.
Mm-hmm.
So I could be a person. I can hang and it just makes it light and easy for everyone. Like that was always my thing, being wherever I am, making that environment as comfortable as possible. Because I want to have a good time. That's my
thing. And you do. I've played with you quite a bit, and I've always had a great time with you on stage. It's been fun, you know. It's always like no stress, you know. And you know, and that what you're saying to young players or people playing music, I think that's an important thing to always be prepared,
mm-hmm.
because being prepared really does take the stress off.
Oh.
You know. And is there anything else that you might want to tell young people playing drums or anybody coming up in this industry, because you have managed to make a career in playing, and knock on wood. And that's real wood, too.
That's right. You know I check first.
You know, just some kind of type of advice that you could share with them in addition to what you were saying and being prepared. And
all right. First of all, you have to be prepared and just, I don't know, like for me, like I said, it's all about being comfortable, being on time, like all those things, like making sure you catch the flight, making sure you're there early enough, like just be the kind of person that you want showing up at your gig.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Always be considerate.
Yeah.
Like if you were doing a gig and you email someone some tunes and some charts, like you want them to show up at least listening to the music one time, right?
Oh, please.
Right?
And how many times has that happened where cats don't listen to the MP3 or even look at it? And you pull out the chart and they look at you like, let's do all what is it? All the things you are. It's like, no, this isn't an all the things you are gig, man, you know.
And like, be that person. Because if you are that person,
mm-hmm.
they're going to call you again. Because they're going to know that, well, he's going to know the music. He's going to get there on time. Mm-hmm. He's going to get there on time with the right attitude. His drums are going to sound good. He's not going to play too loud if the place is small. He's not going to overpower me because I'm singing. I mean, it's etiquette. There is an etiquette, and there, like as a younger player, if you want to survive in this industry, especially the way it is now, if you're not accommodating and able to contribute to a situation, they're not going to call you back because there's so many people out there.
That's true.
So you have to be special.
Yeah. And that's part of being special, in addition to your talent.
Yeah.
When you add that factor to it, it's a very complete package. And it makes for a very successful run in your life to have fun and travel all over the world. And that's what you've done.
Yeah.
And you are incredible.
Oh.
You're amazing, and I've had a really, first of all, just learned so much just in us in our talking today on this. I appreciate you being on the show, you know, and just sharing your time with us and, you know, being who you are, which I love.
Oh, well, I would have it no other way. I mean, when you contacted me, I didn't even think about it. So I was like, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, I love that. I really do really, really appreciate that, because I always find it so important when young players can hear your story, hear stories like yours, and just how much work you've put into being the great drummer you are. You know, I mean, you have busted your behind. You know what I mean? It wasn't like just some instant thing.
Oh, where, no.
You know, it was from the top of the stairs at 5 years old, mirroring what, you know, the drummer's playing to now, you know. And it's very impressive, and I do have the highest regard for you.
Oh,
and
thank you so much
for doing the show. And got to have you back so you can sing your country.
Yes.
Your country tune. You got to sing it. You have to sing the tune and play the guitar. Left-handed. Yes?
Yes. Yes, I'll come back. We'll do the country version of this whole
All right, I'll teach you the twang so you can get that down right, so you don't have the Caribbean Queens accent stuck in there. So anyway, that wraps it up for us on Tales from the Jazz Side.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Jazz Side is always there, waiting for us to enter and waiting to enter us. So, until next time, unplug your ear holes, for you never know what worlds may be waiting for you.